This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. It's Oscars weekend, and we wanted to get in on the fun. So this week, we've got three stories about what happens when sports and Hollywood collide. Don't worry, it's not three stories about Space Jam. In fact, all three of these stories took place decades before Michael Jordan and Bugs Bunny teamed up. But our first story is about basketball. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
This summer at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the United States will go for a fourth straight gold medal in men's basketball. For months, analysts have been speculating about Team USA's roster.
We're talking about Steph, James Harden,
yes.
Right?
Anthony Davis. Yes.
One thing's for sure. Every player on Team USA will be employed by a professional basketball team. But back in 1936, the first year that the Olympics featured basketball, the players representing Team USA were amateurs who played for company teams. In fact, half of that 1936 U.S. Olympic basketball team worked at an oil refinery about 50 miles from Wichita, Kansas. The other half, the reason we're telling this story on Oscars weekend, came from Universal Pictures. Yes, the same Universal Pictures that brought us such timeless classics as E.T., Back to the Future, and all nine Fast and Furious films also gave Team USA half its basketball roster for the 1936 games. And how this happened, how a bunch of guys who worked as stagehands and promoters for a movie studio ended up representing the U.S. at the Nazi games in Berlin, starts with a Jewish immigrant from Germany. A guy who played a leading role in creating Hollywood as we know it today. Carl Laemmle was just 17 in 1884 when he left Germany for the United States. He settled in the Midwest.
And had a variety of jobs.
That's author Andrew Marinus.
But on one trip to Chicago, he saw a long line of people standing outside of a Nickelodeon theater. And he said that there might be some money to be made in this fledgling film business. He started his own Nickelodeon in Chicago and then pretty quickly realized that the real money was to be made in actually creating and distributing the movies. He saw a truck driving down the street with the brand of Universal Pipe Fitters, and that's where this name of Universal came from.
August of 1912, that's when Universal started leasing land out here in Southern California.
That's Jeff Pirtle, director of archives and collections for NBC Universal. Jeff Pirtle says that in those early days, Carl Laemmle's Universal Pictures set itself apart from other studios with its low-budget westerns and comedies that targeted rural markets. And the studio turned a 230-acre plot of land in the San Fernando Valley into Universal City.
This fantasy land where people could go walk down a New York street or walk down a Western street. I've got this great photograph from 1923, and you can see the lower half of the Notre Dame Cathedral that's on the back lot. You can also see a set of Monte Carlo.
Author Andrew Marinus says Carl Laemmle brought family members from Germany to live and work on the studio.
This elaborate town where 300-something people lived. Native Americans lived there, and they were extras in the Western movies that the studio was making at the time. He was the first person to really sort of open up the studio to tourists. So you would have people arriving on bus and sitting in bleachers watching these movies being made.
And they were encouraged to cheer the heroes of the films and to boo the villains because this was all in the silent era.
So how does a basketball team enter the picture?
So in the early 1930s, of course, some of the great films that were being produced at Universal were our classic monster films. Dracula was 1931.
Frankenstein came out later that year.
The Mummy was 1932. The Invisible Man, 1933. So at that time, Universal had a really tight-knit group of employees, and there was formed the Universal City Club, which was an employee group that had bowling leagues, softball leagues. They would have big dinners and dances. And they also had a basketball league.
Now, an important thing to know about this era, professional basketball wasn't yet a big thing. If you had talent and wanted to keep playing after college, your best options were to play for your local YMCA or your company team. And Universal Pictures hired a number of former UCLA players to work as grips, best boys, and electricians on sets, and to play basketball.
The basketball team was an important way that the studio marketed their films. They would travel from town to town, mostly on the West Coast. They carried this banner with them everywhere they went that had the names of famous movie cowboys on it or famous producers. If people had the money to afford to go see a basketball game, they might have the money to afford to go see a movie as well. So really, it was a pretty brilliant marketing strategy by the studio.
The team was organized by a guy named Jack Pierce, who was the head makeup artist at Universal Pictures.
He created the iconic looks for characters like Frankenstein and the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
So Pierce put the team's 6'7" center, Frank Lubin, through an unconventional pregame routine.
They would dress him up as Frankenstein and paint him green. And he would entertain the crowds prior to the basketball games to promote Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein. And then as the game started, he would scurry off to the locker room. They would scrape off the green paint and put him in his basketball uniform. Sometimes he'd come back on the court with a little bit of green still on him and come out and play center.
The Universal team competed in national tournaments.
And they played sort of an old school brand of basketball, slow. The modern eye would consider their brand of basketball boring. They dubbed themselves the Sure Passers. And thought that was a cool name, you know?
It's kind of ironic that the team sponsored by an entertainment company would be like the one that's...
Although I guess you could say winning is the best entertainment if you're an athlete.
That's
so
true.
They won a lot of basketball games.
And at the same time that the Universal Pictures team was showing its skill on the court, the U.S. Olympic Committee was about to determine who'd go to the 1936 Games in Berlin for the inaugural basketball competition.
There was a qualifying tournament played around the country, which culminated with the Elite Eight, if you will, at Madison Square Garden. And it was decided that whichever two teams in that tournament advanced to the championship game would be combined to become the U.S. Olympic team.
The tournament featured college teams, YMCA teams, company-sponsored teams. But not all of the country's best teams participated. For one, black players weren't allowed to compete. And Long Island University, the top college team at the time, riding a 40-plus game winning streak, had five Jewish players. They voted to boycott the qualifying tournament. In fact, author Andrew Marinus says that Carl Laemmle, that's the Universal Pictures founder, the Jewish immigrant from Germany, stopped supporting the company basketball team ahead of the U.S. qualifying tournament in protest of Hitler. But just as the Universals were about to play in New York, Laemmle was also losing control of his studio. Remember how in those early days Universal Pictures made its mark with low-budget westerns and comedies? Well, in 1929, 7 years before the Olympic qualifying tournament, Carl Laemmle gave his son a pretty wild 21st birthday present. He made Carl Laemmle Jr. the head of production.
He really elevated the quality of productions that Universal was making.
That's Jeff Pertl, director of archives and collections at NBC Universal again.
Carl Laemmle Jr.'s really first big production was All Quiet on the Western Front.
But you're just a man like me, and I killed you. Forgive me, comrade.
Which won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1930.
Laemmle Jr. was also responsible for Dracula and Frankenstein and the other famous monster movies.
But in 1936, one of the big productions that Carl Laemmle Jr. greenlit for production was Showboat. And to finance that production, the studio had to get a big loan and put the studio up for collateral.
Showboat got made.
I don't know as I'd like you to go falling in love with some man no one ever heard of.
But the Laemmles weren't able to pay back the loan. Carl Laemmle would have to sell his studio. Meanwhile, the qualifying tournament at Madison Square Garden was getting underway. The Universal Pictures basketball team beat the University of Arkansas, then the Wilmerding, Pennsylvania YMCA. In the championship game, they met the Globe Refiners from McPherson, Kansas. That's really Kansas, not Missouri. Both teams had already earned the right to represent the U.S. at the Olympics. But for good measure, the Universals upset the oil men by a single point to become national champions. No basketball team could stop the Universals from making it to the Berlin Games. But the situation back in Hollywood could. The April 11th, 1936 edition of the magazine Universal Weekly features a photo of the basketball team fresh off its victory at Madison Square Garden, just above a headline that reads, "Charles R. Rogers takes charge of production at Universal City." Lemley had lost his studio.
The new administration really wasn't too keen on sending a group of employees over to Nazi Germany. So the studio pretty much said, okay, you guys are on your own.
If they wanted to go to Germany, the players would have to pay their own way. Not only that, they'd likely lose their jobs at the studio. For the Universal players, it was an easy choice. The only question was, how could they raise the money? A local sports writer had an idea for a fundraiser, an exhibition between the Universals and a team of college all-stars in L.A. It didn't go well. Here's author Andrew Marinus again.
First of all, hardly anybody showed up for the game. I think they only made $500. And then the college all-stars beat the Universals. And so the joke was that the wrong team was going to Berlin.
Things were not looking good. But just before it was too late, some other Hollywood big shots stepped up. They funded the team. James Whale, director of Frankenstein, as well as Showboat, was one benefactor.
Another was Walter Lantz, who was an animator who created Woody Woodpecker. So we've got Frankenstein and Woody Woodpecker to thank for, in part, for the first U.S. Olympic basketball team.
The Universal players boarded a train for New York just in time to catch the SS Manhattan bound for Germany.
They really weren't able to practice much basketball. Initially, they were supposed to practice on deck, and they lost several basketballs into the Atlantic Ocean. So there was a lot of partying, drinking, card playing going on this boat. It sounds like it was just a pleasure cruise.
Luckily, the competition in Germany wasn't particularly challenging. In fact, the U.S.'s first opponent, Spain, forfeited after the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. Marinus says Estonia was supposed to be Europe's best team, but the Americans topped them by 24 points. The plan had been for the Universals and the Globerfiners to remain mostly separate squads and alternate playing on behalf of Team USA. Universal Pictures was supposed to play first and also last in the gold medal game. But because of the Spanish Civil War and the cancellation of that first game, the order got thrown off, and the players from the Globerfiners, not Universal, got to represent the U.S. against Canada for the first Olympic basketball gold medal, which I'm going to bet is not a sentence you expected to hear today. Anyway, the U.S./Globerfiners beat Canada 19-8. The Globerfiners received their gold medals at a ceremony. The Universal Pictures players got their medals in the mail back in L.A. Not exactly a cinematic ending. Well, so what happens to the Universal Pictures team after the Olympics?
It's disbanded, as was the Refiners team from Kansas. Crazy to think about. This is the best team in the world. They win the gold medal, and that's the last time they ever play.
Center Frank Lubin, that's the guy who dressed up as Frankenstein before games, went on to work as a stagehand and play for the team at 20th Century Fox. Universal Pictures never formed another competitive basketball team. Jeff Pirtle also says there was a silver lining to founder Carl Lemley's loss of the studio.
Carl Lemley dedicated the last 3 years of his life to writing affidavits for German Jews to get out of Nazi Germany and come to America. And he wrote over 300 affidavits.
His star is right at the heart of the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and that is well-deserved.
That story came from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For more on the U.S. Olympic basketball team and the 1936 Olympics, check out Andrew Marinus's book, Games of Deception. How did a swimmer turned movie star find herself at the center of an international military competition that spanned seven decades?
Aren't soldiers silly? They're goofy.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month. And all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
I'm Karen Given. Like every good romantic comedy, our next story begins with a classic Hollywood meet-cute. Edward Bell was producing promotional events for the 1984 Olympics, and one day he got a call from McDonald's wondering if he could find a celebrity from the sport of swimming.
I said, well, there's Buster Crabbe.
Buster Crabbe was an actor who had won gold in the freestyle at the 1932 Olympics, but Buster Crabbe didn't work out.
And they said, do you know anybody else? And I said, well, yeah, Esther Williams. And they said, fine, can you get her? And I said, oh, yeah, sure.
Edward didn't actually know Esther Williams, but he did own a telephone.
So I picked up the telephone, and I called her, and I told her what we needed. And she said, would you like to meet for lunch? Of course would I like to meet for lunch. Esther Williams, I saw her movies at Radio City Music Hall when I was a kid.
Edward arranged to meet Esther at a restaurant in L.A.
She was late. She was an hour late. And when I saw her walk in, I stood up and knocked the whole table over. Everything, the wine, the glasses, everything. She thought that was very funny.
Do you remember what Esther ate at that lunch?
I don't remember anything else about the lunch. I think I was so taken by the fact that I'd loved movie stars. I knew a lot of them. She was extraordinary. She was so charming and bright that I was so taken with her.
McDonald's ended up going in another direction, but Edward helped Esther get a different job at those Olympic Games.
Oh, that was a beautiful high boost.
NBC was looking for commentators because it was first Olympics they had synchronized swimming. And Esther was referred to as the mother of synchronized swimming.
The judges are looking for how much they travel, how smoothly they make the transition.
Esther Williams had almost gone to the Olympics herself. In 1939, she was the reigning American 100-meter freestyle champion.
But in 1940, the Olympics were canceled because of the war. So, as Esther said, as compensation, I became a movie star.
And we can have a little huddle tonight.
And her first movie was Andy Hardy's Double Life with Mickey Rooney.
You mean a giraffe party?
Giraffe?
Well, a giraffe has a long neck.
She gave Mickey Rooney an underwater kiss.
Esther Williams starred in a new kind of movie called Aqua Musicals. They were huge MGM productions that spotlighted Esther's grace and power as a swimmer.
And there's a wonderful scene in Million Dollar Mermaid where she rises on the top of a pylon.
So picture Esther in a bodysuit covered in 50,000 gold sequins. A hydraulic lift slowly raises her six stories above the water. When she gets to the top, she calmly looks around and dives off. In real life, the water caught the gold crown secured to Esther's head. She fractured three vertebrae in her neck and was almost paralyzed. But in the movie, in the very next shot, Esther rises up out of the water, smiling, with her arms gracefully raised.
And I think, instinctively, women felt empowered by her. She was athletic, strong, and powerful. I was very proud of her. She had this strength about her, as a woman.
Maybe you've already figured this out by the tone of his voice, but Edward and Esther fell in love.
I was her fourth husband. She was my third wife, and we lasted for 30 years. We had a wonderful, wonderful relationship.
Esther Williams died in 2013, and I didn't call Edward Bell to talk about her career. I called him because I recently learned that this swimmer-turned-movie star was the prize, the face, and the voice of an international military competition that spanned seven decades.
Aren't soldiers silly?
Oh, my goodness.
They're goofy.
We've got lots of ways of being stupid in our forces.
That's Dr. Tom Lewis. He's a military historian. Tom served in the Australian Navy for 20 years, and it wasn't long after he joined in 1983 that he first heard about it.
I think I remember thinking that it was just one of those trophies that ships compete for. So you do have competitions in sport. You have competitions for best gunnery ship and things like that. So I would have thought it was just one of those type trophies.
But it wasn't, as Tom learned on a visit to a place called Spectacle Island.
Spectacle Island is so cool because it was two islands joined by a little strip of land. They have these huge warehouses. They're incredible. They're a couple of hundred metres long, each of them, and air-conditioned.
Spectacle Island is where the Australian Navy keeps its most prized artifacts. And it was there that Tom first saw the photo that the Australian Navy, and later the British, American, and Canadian navies, fought over from 1943 until Esther's death in 2013. It's called the Esther Williams Trophy.
It's a rather odd-looking thing and a rather odd concept of a trophy.
Over the years, a few copies of the Esther Williams Trophy have been made. The one Tom saw is called the Fighting Copy. It's a signed photo of a smiling Esther in a wooden frame inscribed with "Take me if you dare" and "Carry me with honor." You're probably picturing a photo of Esther Williams in a swimsuit with legs for days, but Edward Bell wants you to know, this wasn't that.
It's not like Rita Hayworth or Betty Grable, where she were showing legs and bodies. This was a pretty picture. Looks like a star.
She was the prettiest thing in the Pacific at that time. You know, it was wartime at the time, 1943.
That's William Fury, U.S. Navy retired. He first saw the Esther Williams Trophy in 1956 while serving aboard the aircraft carrier USS Boxer.
She was the only picture that was on any of those ships, okay? We had pinups, but they had to be in your locker.
But the Esther Williams Trophy could be displayed right out in the open. In fact, that was one of the rules. If you liberated the trophy from another ship, you had to display it in your wardroom, the officer's mess. There were other rules, too. Here's historian Tom Lewis again.
The trophy is to remain unsecured and in full view. The trophy may only be removed by force, preferably of the brute variety, or by exceedingly low cunning and vile stealth. Use of enlisted personnel in any fashion is prohibited. The only other restrictions against firearms and clubs. Unsuccessful suitors are to be given haircuts and lodging. So haircuts and lodging would mean you'd probably have half your hair shaved off and you'd be locked inside a bathroom for a couple of hours or something like that.
And did you catch that bit about use of enlisted personnel is prohibited? This was a game for officers, and William Fury was enlisted, which meant that instead of khakis, he wore dungarees. We'd call them jeans today.
One of the officers came up to me and he says, "Hey, you're my size. Can I borrow your clothes?" I says, "What are you going to do, rob a bank or what, you know?" So, no. He says, "You'll see." Well, anyway, I gave him my dungarees, and they went over to the USS Salem, and they went aboard it and stole the picture of Esther Williams. And they brought it back and put it aboard our ship, and then the rest of the ships were all trying to steal it off of us. It was a game.
Once a ship captured Esther, they had to do two things. They'd fly a pennant, a special flag that let the rest of the fleet know that Esther was aboard. And they'd send out a message, often written as if Esther herself was sending it.
The idea of facing another winter bouncing all over the West Australian exercise area makes me a little chucky. I'm sick of feeling green and very keen to feel blue. Esther Williams sends.
Here's a piece of the message the USS Boxer sent out. It was in verse.
"Forbear, sweet loss, those British paws and regiment with heart of oak. They fought, alas, for a lost cause, those rugged men of Roanoke."
While in port, the Boxer was connected via long ropes to two submarines.
Conventionals. They weren't nukes at that time.
And once the submarine officers learned that Esther was aboard the Boxer, they attacked.
Submarine officers come aboard our ship and threw a smoke bomb in the hangar deck. And we went to fire quarters. Everybody runs to their battle stations or fire quarters. Okay, everybody's got a place to be.
And if you think sending sailors to battle stations over a photo of a swimmer turned movie star sounds dangerous, you'd be right. Many a raid for the Esther Williams Trophy ended with injuries and water rescues. The attackers took Esther and sped back to their submarine. The Boxer's officers pursued them, but when they climbed aboard the sub and started to try to open the hatches, the sub suddenly submerged.
The submarine is submerging right there, and they're all floating on top of it. So that was the end of that. They lost the battle.
Les Wood served in the Canadian Navy for 28 years. He crossed paths with the Esther Williams Trophy sometime during the Korean War. He doesn't remember the exact year.
At 97 years old, you forget things.
Fair point. So sometime during the Korean War, Les and his fellow officers of the HMCS Haida were invited over to another Canadian ship to see the trophy.
In Canadian ships, of course, they have liquor, so went in and had a few drinks, and they brought out the Esther Williams Trophy, showed it to everybody, and everybody was passing it around. And we had heard about the trophy as being a thing that the ships were having fun trying to steal from each other. So I was talking to one of my friends, and I said, you know, just for fun, we should steal it. And he says, good idea.
On their way in, Les and his friend had noticed that the ship's gangway went right past one of the wardroom windows, or portholes, and it was open.
And he went outside and down the ladder, right past the porthole that we saw was open. The rest of us passed it around until we got to the window or the porthole. I passed it out to him. He took it and took off to our ship, took the trophy and hid it there.
Les doesn't remember where exactly his friend hid the trophy.
When you get to be 97, you forget a few things. Oh, I forgot that I told you that already, too.
And here's where we get to the final rule of the Esther Williams Trophy. It had to stay in the Pacific, and Les Wood and the Haida were about to head back home.
There were three American ships there, too, and we passed the trophy to them. And, of course, every other ship in the fleet now was after these three ships. So when we sailed out to the harbor that day, it was like a war going on with fire hoses and everything else. And I don't know who ever got it in the end, but that's the last I saw of it.
The Esther Williams Trophy was retired in 1957, and that should have been the end of the story. But Mick DeYoung came across the Esther Williams Trophy much later, in the 2000s. He's not in the Navy, but he spends months at a time cruising around in his sailboat. When he first saw the trophy, he was sailing in a very remote part of Australia's Northern Territory.
And honestly, you just don't see a boat up there at all. And in the bay just north of us, I saw a small patrol boat come in and anchor. It was a good, 5 miles away.
Mick's partner, Cheryl, has a brother in the Navy. And so they looked at each other and thought, wouldn't it be amazing if Cheryl's brother was on that ship? Mick radioed the ship, and believe it or not, Cheryl's brother was there. Mick and Cheryl were invited aboard.
And at the end of the tour, we were in the wardroom, the officer's mess, and on the wall was a picture of Esther Williams. The XO was showing us around, the second in charge of the ship. And I asked him, what's this all about? And he said, oh, it's a great story.
Turns out, back in 1997, 40 years after the trophy had been retired, it was being housed on Spectacle Island. You remember Spectacle Island, that place with the Navy's most precious artifacts?
So the officers of the HMAS Brisbane, I think.
He's right. It was the Brisbane.
Were being shown through by the curator of the museum. And the museum curator was sort of saying, back when men was real men, this was the Esther Williams Trophy, and we used to fight for this. And this is all speculation, of course.
Mick has no idea what was really said. But whatever it was, the officers of the Brisbane took the curator's words as a challenge.
At the end of the tour, they said, oh, we'd like to invite you back to the HMAS Brisbane. So, the next day, the curator of the museum comes to the HMAS Brisbane. They show him through, and at the end they said, we've got a presentation to make for you. And they hand him over the stolen item.
After a 40-year hiatus, the Esther Williams Trophy was back in service. Over the years, some of the sailors wrote to Esther Williams, the real one, back in Hollywood, and they'd tell her of her trophy's grand adventures in the Pacific. Esther would sometimes write back. Edward Bell says his wife was honored and a bit amazed by all the fuss.
She had a good feeling about the trophy, that she was part of this.
And there's one more story about the Esther Williams Trophy I want to tell. When Mick DeJong got back home from that sailing trip in the early 2000s, he decided to try to find the original owner of that photo. Mick's only lead was the sailor's name, Leslie Brand.
We've got literally thousands of L Brands in every state. So I thought, I'm never, ever going to find this fella. So I picked one phone number out of all of these phone numbers, and I thought, I'll just give it a go. So I rang, and I got an answering machine saying, hello, you've got Lindsay and Betty Brand. Please leave a message after the beep. I couldn't believe my luck.
Mick left a message, but he never heard back. A few days later, he called again.
And I got hold of Betty, and she goes, who are you? What do you want? And I said, look, I'm just, you know, doing some research on the Esther Williams Trophy. How do you know about the Esther Williams Trophy? That's just a story he tells the kids.
By this time, the Esther Williams Trophy had been held by more than 200 ships from four different navies. And Lindsay, Betty, and the kids, who were now in their 60s, had no idea.
Betty said, oh, he's going to want to talk to you. And I told Lindsay the full story. And he goes, I think I'm going to need a stiff drink.
And that's when Mick DeJong was finally able to answer the biggest question of them all. How did a swimmer turned movie star become the prize, the face, and the voice of an international military competition that spanned seven decades? It began with Lindsay Brand and Captain David Stevenson. They were in Durban, South Africa.
They were both frequenting the Stardust nightclub. Both trying to, you know, pick up a certain young lady.
Just to be perfectly clear, this certain young lady was not named Esther Williams. You're going to hear Lindsay Brand's words here, but this isn't his voice. We asked an actor to read his words from interviews and his unpublished memoir.
David Stevenson, pleased with himself for having beaten me for the honor of squiring a certain young lady, presented me with a framed photo of a luscious and eminently kissable Esther Williams.
The captain signed the photo, to my own Georgie, with all my love and a passionate kiss.
Why did he sign it as Georgie? Well, as they were passing each other, any officer was passing each other on the ship, you would call him Georgie and he would call you Charlie, or you'd call him Charlie, g'day Georgie.
This is during the war, remember. Officers were targets.
That was going to be the end of the story. I had this lovely picture of Esther. But then someone came along out of the blue, went into my cabin, and took it away.
That wouldn't do. So Lindsay got some help and stole his photo back.
No bloodshed, no blows, no nothing. Just we took it.
And that's really all there was to that. A few years after Mick found Lindsay, the Australian Navy arranged a ceremony to reunite the sailor with his picture of Esther Williams, if only temporarily. And then in 2010, Lindsay Brand died.
I found Lindsay only a few years before he passed away, so I got to tell him all those years later that something that he and Captain Stevenson started was such a great morale booster for all the Allied navies. And it just went on for so many years. It's what a great tradition.
When Esther Williams died in 2013, the Australian Navy officially retired her trophy again. They sent out one more ship-to-ship communication.
I was the mermaid of the Australian Navy, the desire of all who go to sea.
This time, instead of keeping Esther in one of those warehouses at Spectacle Island, every known copy of the trophy is on display in the Navy Heritage Center in Sydney, open to the public, but locked away under glass, presumably to prevent further theft.
For the final time, Esther Williams sends.
Coming up, we'll have the story of a Hollywood movie deal that changed the way Major League Baseball does business. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Do eat this, don't eat that. If you feel like it's time to finally end your war with food, this is the podcast for you. Food, we need to talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. We have one more story about what happens when sports and Hollywood collide. And this one changed how Major League Baseball does business. No, really. Reporter Susan Vallett has the story.
I didn't think it was going to be such a big deal. I mean, over the years, it just keeps coming back.
Paul Pettit is 88 now. I grew up with his youngest daughter, and when we were kids, I called him Mr. Pettit. Until recently, I had no idea that Mr. Pettit was important to the history of baseball. I only knew that he had played the game when he was younger.
I was kind of good at throwing a ball, and I always threw it a little bit harder than most kids, so I just automatically gravitated to pitching.
Pettit wasn't yet in high school when people first started noticing his talent.
There were a lot of leagues at that time in Southern California, amateur leagues.
That's Dan Taylor, author of the baseball book Fate's Takeout Slide.
His best friend was his catcher later in the high school team, Gar Myers. And Gar had gotten on an amateur team and encouraged Paul to come to a tryout, which Paul did. The coach of this team was a scout for the St. Louis Browns. And he changed Paul's pitching mechanics. Almost instantly, Paul went from kind of a mediocre type of talent to a phenom.
Pettit's style was similar to that of baseball great Sandy Koufax, who would come along much later. Once he got to high school in the mid to late 1940s, Pettit helped his school's baseball team go to several citywide championships. He pitched six no-hitters and struck out 390 batters over 140 innings, including 27 in a single game.
I didn't lose a game in the last couple of years myself. I was fortunate enough to be one of them that didn't lose.
Legendary scout Rosie Gilhausen, then with the Hollywood Stars of the Pacific Coast League, heard about Pettit from another scout.
When Rosie saw Paul, he was certainly sold on him and befriended him. And Gar and Paul really took a liking to him. And after school, they would ride their bikes to Rosie's house, and Rosie would regale them with baseball stories. And he would take them to Gilmore Field and take them to Hollywood Stars games, and he would take them downstairs into the VIP lounge.
He showed us, you know, baseball attracts some real successful people. And that's what's so exciting to me.
Little did Pettit know that he'd soon have his own fans.
When Paul was in his senior season at Narbonne High School in 1949, the administration of the school had to bring bleachers from the football field over to the baseball field because there were so many people coming to watch him play. You go back and you look at the six daily newspapers in Southern California at that time, and you know Paul was written up as much as any of the Rams, any of the Hollywood Stars, any of the top athletes of the day. I contend that Paul was the greatest amateur player in America at that time. And teams had multiple scouts following him. And the scouts weren't just evaluating him. Scouts would go out and they would go to the coaches at SC and UCLA and arrange for Paul's high school team to play them so that they could gauge Paul pitching against stronger competition. And all the players on both teams were told not a word of this is ever to be breathed to the media. And I think the college coaches were most appreciative of that because Paul's team beat them.
Pettit says the scouts and all of the attention didn't make him nervous.
I worried more about winning the games and pitching well than I did the scouts.
Before his senior year of high school, as Pettit was warming up for a game, Pittsburgh Pirates scout Babe Herman came over and watched him pitch for a while.
He says, you know, you should get at least $90,000 to sign. And he says, if you don't, there's something wrong, or some words to that effect. And I kept that in my mind. So right after that, I start getting offers. I use that knowledge and not to sign with him.
This was before Major League Baseball had a draft. Instead, teams would lure top amateurs with signing bonuses. But while Pettit was in high school, the major leagues passed something called the bonus rule.
The objective was to level the playing field, to prevent the big money teams, at that time the Yankees, the Detroit Tigers, for example, from spending lavishly and corralling all the best amateur players. So as kind of a penalty, any player out of high school, college, who signed with a team and received a bonus of $4,000 or more had to spend their first season in professional baseball in the big leagues.
These bonus babies, as they were called, often warmed the bench and lost out on valuable playing time they could have had on semi-pro teams. That's when Frederick Stefani comes into this story. Stefani was a Hollywood producer, best known for co-writing and directing a popular science fiction serial film in 1936.
And I'm Flash Gordon.
Gordon? Gordon. Professor Gordon's son?
Yeah, that's right.
This was an era full of baseball movies, like The Story of Babe Ruth, It Happens Every Spring, and Take Me Out to the Ball Game with Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly.
Hey, take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Stefani wanted to make a baseball movie.
He couldn't get Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio or any of those big stars. They wanted too much money, so he tried to pick somebody else while they were an amateur before they got into pro ball.
And of course, reading the newspapers, you know, every 3 or 4 days, they were seeing the name Paul Pettit. Paul's father received a telegram one day, and it was from Stefani wanting to arrange a meeting. And they didn't know what it could possibly be about, so Paul and his dad and his mother and his girlfriend, Shirley, all went to Stefani's office, and Stefani told him that he wanted to lock up Paul on a multi-year contract to do exclusive pictures for Stefani's company. Contract called for $85,000.
But Stefani didn't plan to pay Pettit the money called for in that contract himself. He planned to get baseball to do it.
It basically gave Stefani the rights to negotiate on Paul's behalf with big league teams, which had never been done before. There was no such thing as player agents at that time. Paul was really the first player ever to be represented by an agent.
So Stefani shopped Pettit around to teams.
And Paul and his dad went to Frederick Stefani's office. And when they were ushered in, there were executives of the Pittsburgh Pirates there, the general manager Roy Hamey and a few of the scouts. And Hamey reached out to shake their hand and said, congratulations, we've purchased your contract. And I believe he made mention of the $85,000 figure. And Paul's father said, not so fast. My son's not signing for a penny less than $100,000. The men got very surprised looks on their faces, and they adjourned to a private office and came back a little bit later and said, okay, you've got your deal. And Paul, in talking to one of the scouts, a couple of years later, the scout said, boy, were we glad you accepted just $100,000, because we were actually prepared, if you guys were tougher negotiators, to go to $125,000. Still, it was a record signing. There had never been a player signed for a six-figure bonus before. So Paul was the first in baseball history to sign for $100,000.
Stefani got to keep the movie rights, the Pittsburgh Pirates got a top prospect, and Pettit came to be known as the first $100,000 bonus baby. And since Pettit's contract was technically a personal services contract with Stefani and not a regular baseball contract, it got around the bonus rule. He could start his career in the minors instead of taking up valuable space on Pittsburgh's major league roster.
That created a lot of outrage in the game. The Cardinals, the Yankees, the Brooklyn Dodgers, to name three, they screamed bloody murder. They wanted investigations launched.
The teams figured that Stefani, an independent producer, couldn't possibly have pulled this off on his own. And of course, they blamed the most logical person.
I'm dreaming of a white.
They pointed a finger at Bing Crosby. They felt because Bing Crosby was a part owner of the Hollywood Stars that he had in some way utilized Stefani to be able to angle Paul toward the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Crosby also happened to be a part owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates. He even posed with Pettit at his first spring training with the Pirates in 1950.
So the feeling was that this Hollywood involvement in Paul Pettit, it could only have come from Bing Crosby.
The league investigated and turned up nothing, but Taylor says there's still speculation.
And I've read and talked to a few people who felt that it wasn't Bing, but there was a Hollywood involvement to it.
Pettit started his major league career by pitching a perfect inning as a relief pitcher in an exhibition game against the New York Yankees. He was then assigned to the Southern League's New Orleans Pelicans. Things were going great. He was on his way to a long major league career.
But it was about that time a number of coaches began to tinker with Paul. They started to tinker with his motion. And Paul said almost immediately he began to feel a little stress. He had had an injury in his next to last high school game. He was playing center field, and he made a diving catch and landed on his left shoulder. And he came up, and from his knees, he threw out the runner who had been trying to tag up and go from second to third. And the next time out, the final game of Paul's high school career, he really didn't have the same movement on his fastball, and his curve didn't break as well. And his catcher questioned him on it and said, "Are you hurt?" And Paul insisted that he wasn't.
Still, Pettit got off to a good start with the Pelicans.
And then in, I believe it was his third game of the regular season, he was in the second inning of the game, and he just felt a pop and a pain in his left elbow.
Called the trainer out and said, "I think my elbow, I hurt my arm." And he says, "Well, try another one or two." And I tried it one or two more. And I said, "That's it. I can't pitch anymore."
And for all practical purposes, his career was over. The fastball was gone. He had a lot of pain. By then, Branch Rickey was in running the Pittsburgh Pirates, and he didn't have a lot of tolerance for players that talked about injuries, and he questioned whether Paul just wasn't tough enough to play.
Pettit played two seasons with the Pirates and even pitched for the Hollywood Stars in an early live televised game in 1952, which attracted a record 500,000 viewers at a time when TV sets were not common. He tried to shift his focus to batting and did well, but never got another shot at the big leagues. In 1961, after he received his last bonus check, Pettit retired and became a teacher and coach. Even though Paul Pettit's baseball career was short, baseball author Dan Taylor says he changed the sport.
Paul was obviously the first to use an agent, and I think that was significant. His signing bonus obviously met a very unique benchmark. Paul was the glaring sign that the bonus rule was not going to work.
And that led to the draft, which started in 1964, shaping Major League Baseball into what we know today. And Frederick Stefani's baseball movie about Pettit?
No, it never happened, because I didn't happen.
That story came from reporter Susan Vallett. If you like what you've heard from this sports show masquerading as a Hollywood show, please do us a favor and subscribe to our podcast. And leave us a 5-star review. That's like our version of winning an Oscar. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.